This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Our show today focuses in mainly on education topics. In fact, we have Carmen McCollum with the Times of Northwest Indiana talking about her series of articles about education here in the region. We'll also have Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune weighing in on some of the education stories of the week that she's covered for the newspaper and online. And we'll also talk with Andy Ober from Inside Indiana Business on some interesting education-related business stories that he's covered as well. Plus, we'll also have Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Eric Weddle with us as well with some of his stories of the week. It's Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking, and let's take some time to check in on first on educational issues here in Northwest Indiana with Carmen McCollum, who is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Carmen, thanks for being with us today.
You are certainly welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. We have some great stories to talk about here. Let's start in first here with one of the stories that you had not only online but in print in the Times this week about, I guess, a series of articles that dealt with Northwest Indiana education issues and opportunities to talk with teachers and other people about these issues. And in particular, I found interesting one of the articles that of the series that you had, and continuing, I guess, talking about the impact of what public school referendums have on educators. And you had a chance to talk with teachers, a number of other people about it. Tell us about that, please.
I invited teachers from Lakeport and LaPorte County to participate in a roundtable discussion where we could talk about education, what's going on, and et cetera. And one of the topics was referendums. They had a lot of interesting things to say about it. And I had teachers in districts where referendums had passed, for example, in Munster, mm-hmm. where they just in May passed two referendums, one a general fund referendum and two a construction referendum. And general fund is the operating budget, what they use every day to pay teachers' salaries, benefits, and some school programs. So it's very interesting. Teachers had their own take on that. Most of them understand the importance of them, but they also talked about, because I had a teacher from Gary, they also talked about how if a community does not support the effort and possibly does not see the importance of education and to raise their taxes for education, it does not pass. It has not passed in the communities of Gary and East Chicago most recently.
Mm-hmm. And we noticed that, that it has impact, of course, as you mentioned, about Munster, the beginning there two referenda passed, and also the other communities as well have had referenda in recent years passed as well. Valparaiso, of course, most notably, because they actually have opened up a new school in Valparaiso south of U.S. 30 that was never there before, and that was as a result of the voters and patrons of the Valparaiso Community Schools approving a referenda several years ago. One of the things I note in the article that I thought was interesting, and you can tell us more detail about it, is that the teachers' views not only about the referenda, but in general, how Indiana public school districts are funded. That's the main thing. And I think they along with a lot of other people, have seen the need for a complete restructuring of that funding formula.
Yes, they are all very concerned about the funding formula. And it's difficult to understand. If you call it up online and look at it, I mean, it just is difficult to understand and to understand how that money is distributed to schools and things like that, and why some schools get more money and some schools get less money. The teachers have just as much as an objection to it as, the school leaders, the superintendents, the school finance officers. They have problems with the funding formula. It's not clear that anything is going to be done with it. The next legislature that meets is not a budget session coming up. Mm-hmm. That's every 2 years, and they've already passed the budget.
One of the other stories I know that you had worked on here was talking about a new charter school opening up in Hammond. Tell us about this new school and what they're going to be focusing on.
Now, that's a very interesting school. It's going to be similar to the Gary Middle College that the charter school that's over in Gary. The Excel Center, there are several of them around the state, and there are others around the country. I think what's so interesting about them is that they are operated and were started by the Goodwill Industries. I never knew that Goodwill Industries had anything to do with schools, but they do indeed, and they created this special arm just to start schools. They work with students, young people, adults who are at least 18 years old who have dropped out of school. Now, mind you, they will not be getting the GED equivalent. They'll be getting an actual high school diploma.
Wow.
They've got things set up where you can go during the morning time if that's better for you, or you can go during the afternoon if that works better for you, and you'll be able to take the classes that you need to earn your degree. Say, for example, that somebody is, say 18, and they ended school and they had about 25 credits, and you need 45 credits to graduate. 40 or 45, I'm not sure. I'm not looking at the Indiana Core 40 diploma, but they need a certain amount of credits to graduate high school. They will make sure that you take those credits, and it's not just an online program. There are teachers who are going to be there to work with you. They will also have people to help you with your, similar to counselors, to work with you and help you with your life plans, what you want to do, how you can be successful, if you want to go into college or if you want to go into a training program. They've got those people there to help those students, and they're taking applications right now. They're starting classes in early September.
We're talking with Carmen McCollum, who's education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, here on this Reporter Roundtable Thursday about the stories that she's covered online and in print for the Times. One of the other stories I want to talk about involves the Gary Community Schools. We, of course, have kept up with all the problems that academically and financially that the school district has had. We know it's gotten to the point now where there is an emergency manager team that is in place in the Gary Community Schools, and they've had a chance here just recently to take a look in more detail at the problems that they are facing and had a chance to talk with reporters about us. Tell us about that.
Well, that is very interesting, and that's going to be an ongoing topic. Peggy Hinckley is the emergency manager. Hinckley has had something called Hinckley Consulting, and she's a retired superintendent. She's doing a really good job of going through and trying to make sure that she looks at everything thoroughly. She's gone through all the buildings, her and the team from MGT. They've gone through the buildings. They've checked roofs. They've checked bathrooms. They're looking at plumbing. They're trying to get as many things fixed and repaired before school starts Thursday. Yesterday, she had a session with reporters where she talked about being about 90% there, so that they've gotten a lot of those problems tackled. I was kind of stunned myself when I was talking to Ron Gordon, the operations manager, and he said there had not been a plumber there to fix plumbing problems in 3 years.
Good grief.
They had bathrooms, they had stalls, they had urinals, they had sinks that had garbage bags on them, and the children know not to go into that one because you can't use anything, or that, you know, there might have only been two or three toilets that could be used. Dr. Hinckley talked about having spent $500,000 plus so far just on getting these basic problems taken care of so the school can open, the buildings are clean, and when you go in, you can tell that the buildings are sparkling clean.
That's
the
great.
Floor is clean, the bathrooms have been repainted, the bathroom, the toilets, the facilities work, and there is toilet tissue, something that teachers have been talking about for several years, not having had, and they actually buy those things, keep them in their classrooms, and then dole them out to their students as needed. But things look like they're shaping up. The superintendent, Dr. Pruitt, is still working very hard. Dr. Hinckley is not doing things that a superintendent would do. She's doing overall things to make the corporation better. Dr. Pruitt is still there running the day-to-day things for the corporation. there are going to be some changes. Dr. Hinckley told me that she's going to be looking at, you know, not right now, not right away, but at some point they're going to look at the enrollment and they're going to figure out how many buildings need to be open. Mm-hmm. Right now, I believe that there are 15 school buildings open. 13 school buildings open. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make a mistake and say the wrong thing. I think it's 13 school buildings that are open. And they're going to be looking and trying to decide how many students they have, how many buildings ought they to be operating. And if there are too many, then she's going to make some changes. And, you know, she was hired to turn around the academics as well as the finances. The school, she takes precedence over the school board, and she reports directly to the Indiana Distress Unit Appeals Board.
And we know that, Carmen, we've talked about this before, too, that the people are keeping a close eye all across Indiana on how the emergency manager team is doing. This is the first ever state takeover of an entire school district in the Hoosier State, so I know that other school districts that are having problems, maybe not as dire problems as the Gary Community Schools have and have to deal with here, they're probably hoping that they can get something good out of this process that State Senator Eddie Melton helped establish.
Yeah, and I think so. And tune in to the Times. Make sure you keep up with NWI.com. I'll be writing a story on some of those other districts that might possibly be having some financial problem. I'm looking just in our area of Northwest Indiana, not throughout the state, but mm-hmm. in our area, what's going on with the finances. We've had so many schools that have had the referendums that gives you an idea. And for example, Munster also just passed the two referendums, general fund and the construction referendum,
right.
And they went into that process. And if you recall, they had an $8 million deficit. They were able to knock that down to about a $4 million deficit, and that's what they had when the referendums were passed.
Carmen McCollum covers educational affairs for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And thank you, as always, Carmen, for being with us to talk about the stories that you've worked on here. Looking forward to more coming out here and more updates as well, too, of course, on topics like the Gary Community Schools and how they're dealing with the problems they have. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
By the way, the latest piece that Carmen has in Times online and in print on a series that she's been working on deals with the technology in Northwest Indiana schools. You can check that out now online or pick up a copy of the Times as well. More stories about education on Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking. Let's turn now to Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune, who's covered a number of them in Gary and other communities here. Carol, as always, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of the ones that you covered that were out in print in the Post Tribune and online, too, deal again with Gary Community Schools. Let's take up the issue first here about the Gary Boys Academy that had to close. And that was a decision that had to come down here by the team that's come in to help deal with the problems at the school.
That's correct. They announced it at a board meeting that was a kind of an unusual meeting in that the decision had already been made by emergency manager Peggy Hinckley. She just announced it, that the Watson Boys Academy had been closed because its enrollment was just too low to sustain it.
Do you think that this is not going to be an unusual situation, that the emergency manager team headed by Dr. Hinckley is going to take a look at the enrollment? Certainly, as the school year gets started, you always expect changes that have to happen. And sometime, and of course, they have official benchmarks, I guess, is the best way to term that the State Board of Education wants to know from every individual school district how many students are showing up at certain times. And a lot of times this has to do with how much money is being sent to the school district and all. Do you think we're going to find maybe more enrollment figures closely looked at?
I think she's going to keep a close watch on what's happening in the schools. She initially told us that there would not be any closings, at least imminent closings, until she got her feet on the ground and kind of got her bearings. Well, it didn't take long when she saw 128 students at this Watson school. It's a pretty big-sized school that could probably hold 400 kids, mm-hmm. and it just wasn't feasible to keep that school open.
Have you heard whether they've been able to successfully relocate those students?
Yeah, all the parents were telephoned and told of the closing a couple weeks ago. And these parents were given the choice of sending their children to Williams, which is fortunately for the parents and the school district, Williams is just a short distance away, just maybe two blocks from Watson. So for most of them, Williams would be, you know, fall under the neighborhood school category.
One of the other stories I know you took time to go into, and a lot of it has to do with, it's a continuing story in a way, too, for the Gary Community Schools, is dealing with the school buses, with the Illinois Central School Service, School Bus Service, that has been a contractor for the school district for a few years now, and I think made some changes in one of the decisions here, dealing with this transportation here before the start of the school year. Tell us what happened and how that shaped up.
Well, in the ever-changing way in which the school district is governed, the state approved a contract with Illinois Central for, through this coming year, and attorneys felt it prudent for the Gary School Board to also offer its approval on the same contract. Mm-hmm. So there was a little pushback on the school board when it came time to approve the contract. A lot of the, a small number of the board members weren't all that happy with the performance by Illinois Central. Felt like the contract was kind of getting rammed down their throats.
I know that I remember from years past where they had had issues and had to work things out as the school year started, and sometimes problems that continued on off and on during the school year. It wasn't just a very first back-to-school type of issue. It had gone on for some time in the past.
Yeah, that was a few years back. Yeah. Last year, I don't think the issues were too bad.
I get the impression that probably that the initial problems were problems that Illinois Central ran into because they'd just taken over the contract, and they were probably kind of feeling their way through the process as well of making sure the buses are out there and picking up youngsters. And since you have a school district such as the Gary Community Schools that is so spread out over the entire city.
It's also basically an open enrollment district. You could go wherever you want. Mm-hmm. So you could have somebody who lives on the west side who decides they want to go to Ward Emerson on the east side, and you have to coordinate the buses so they can get to that school. The contract that was approved, I just found it in my notes, Illinois Central will get somewhere between $3.8 million and $4.2 million through next year, until August 1st anyway of next year. So that's dependent on the routes and the number of students they serve.
That's what I wondered. It kind of comes back, like you said, it comes back to the fact that the school district is so large for so few students, the 5,000 or so that mm-hmm. are signed up for school within the Gary Community School District. One of the other stories I wanted you to talk about here, it was very interesting too, that you had in the Post-Tribune, talks about teachers in Gary, in the public schools, finding jobs in the charter schools, which we know are in plentiful supply in the city of Gary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gary's got its share of charter schools. They have about eight, I believe. And what happened is a lot of Gary, some 40 Gary teachers were laid off because of all these changes and downsizing, and they started looking for other jobs. And if you don't want to leave your city, you can just go down the street and find a charter school.
Well, that's interesting. What kind of reaction have you got to have a chance to talk with some of these teachers for your story? What did they seem to think about? They obviously weren't happy about having to leave the Gary Community Schools, but they probably were glad they could find at least a job as an educator someplace close by.
Yeah, the teachers I spoke with I happened to be at an orientation, a teacher orientation at the 21st Century Charter School, and a lot of the teachers were just tired of the anxiety of never knowing if your school was going to be closed, or if you would lose your job, or if the entire Gary district might be shut down, or what, you know, just the uncertain future. So they started looking around for other jobs and became new employees of charter schools.
That's interesting. Well, hopefully that they'll find a little more stable employment that way, too. And certainly, as we've already mentioned about the fact that, in fact, that your colleague Your fellow colleague from the Times, Carmen Collum, had mentioned in her conversation we had with her, talking about the fact that they're taking a close look at how many more schools in this Gary Community School District will have to close in the time in between the now and the time that the emergency manager team finishes up their work. Hopefully they will. And we'll find out what happens as far as more teachers in the city of Gary shifting jobs as well, too. And finally, Carol, we had a story in the Post-Tribune here about the trades program at the Merrillville High School growing. It's an interesting topic to talk about here. We talk about STEM research or STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, but we don't talk that much about the trades. And we know that's an area that has to be explored deeply in making sure that people in Northwest Indiana have jobs.
A lot of the Merrillville High students are very much into their trades program, so much so that the school board recently agreed to expand the building where they hold these classes. It's a standalone building out by the tennis courts at Merrillville High School, mm-hmm. and to accommodate the additional students, that they're going to put about 1,000-square-foot addition to that building.
That's great. That's great. What classes or types of classes, maybe I should say, that you've learned, do they offer there in the trades program at Merrillville High School?
Well, they call it a building trades class, and it kind of runs the gamut of what you might expect from, you know, carpentry to some electrical, and I don't know if they get into plumbing and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they do, but.
Well, it sounds like at least it's a great program for young people to learn at least the basics of these building mm-hmm. trade skills. And if they find that that's what they'd like to do, then, of course, they can get involved in the union training programs that are set up for the specific unions that they would probably have to become members of, or apprentices, certainly, and then become members of in time. So it's interesting that it should work out that way. Besides the physical expansion, have you heard from the Merrillville School District whether that's they're going to take on more students? Or that's they obviously are expanding because they probably have a growing enrollment.
Right, that will allow them. They didn't give a number of how many more students they'd be able to serve, but they're at their max right now. So they said they had more requests than they have space for students at this point. And it's going to take this new facility won't be ready this year. It'll likely open next year,
mm-hmm.
so they'll have to. Wait until next year to actually formalize that expansion.
Well, it sounds like more activities happening with the Merrillville Community Schools with this expansion of the trades program physically and eventually with enrollment as well, too. Carol Carlson with the Post-Tribune has been covering these stories online and in print, and we're glad to have her on Regionally Speaking today to talk about it. Thanks so much. We hope to talk with you again soon.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. If you will, tell us a little bit first here. One of the stories that you have here is an interesting study that the Indiana Chambers turned out here.
Yeah, this was a big comprehensive study. The idea being they wanted to see if Indiana's smaller school districts, so primarily in rural areas, were keeping up with their larger counterparts. And what they found is, unfortunately, kind of what they expected, which is that they are just not big enough to provide the outcomes that they believe students really need. This was done through the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State. And what they found was the resources just aren't there to help these districts with 2,000 or fewer students not only achieve the test scores they need, but prepare for college and careers. And in addition to the lower test scores, what they found was these schools are also not able to provide enough high-level courses, AP courses, college placement courses that can help these students prepare. So one of the options given was, you know, they say absolutely has to be on the table, is mergers. One of the things the study found is that small school districts, almost without exception, are adjacent to other small school districts. So mm-hmm. You can find this, you know, one school district that has maybe a few hundred students and another that maybe has a few hundred students. If they can combine and pool resources, maybe they can get closer to this student achievement number that they need to have.
I know it's going to be interesting to see what reaction comes about from these smaller school districts. Even, as you say, if they're adjacent to other districts that could take on the additional students and become a larger district, everybody seems to want to keep hold of their own turf. They're very protective of their own students and their own facilities, their own teachers and the like. I'm sure they're going to have something very interesting to say about this, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of districts are resistant to this, but another factor that goes into this that the study found is the problem is only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
The population trends continue to be toward larger metropolitan areas. So these small school districts have gotten smaller over the last few years, and the projections are that that is only going to continue over the next few years. So really, they're going to have to consider these moves, whether it's at the top of their list or not.
One of the other education-related stories I know that Inside Indiana Business highlighted this week was something that came out of Bloomington and Indianapolis. It's concerning, I guess, the goals for an IU Bicentennial Campaign program. Tell us, I guess it turned out to be very good news at that, wasn't it?
Yeah, for four straight years now, IU has been doing this multi-year Bicentennial Campaign heading into their Bicentennial Celebration, which is in 2020. This is a $2.5 billion campaign, and for four straight years, they have topped their yearly goals. And so not only is this coming from governmental grants, but it's coming from individual donors and organizations and companies. They said that since the public phase of this began in 2012, there have been over 200,000 different donors that have given to this campaign. So this is not only for scholarships, but facilities, new athletic programs, endowed faculty positions. And one thing IU is saying, and this is a big trend in philanthropic giving across the board, but really especially with universities, is people donating aren't just donating in general. They are donating with ideas for where they want their money to go. And that is creating really specialized programs and filling specialized needs, like I said, including scholarships, including new academic programs or facilities. So IU is really touting success with this. And like I said, for four straight years, they've topped goals and are certainly on their way to meet this $2.5 billion goal when this particular campaign wraps up at the end of 2019 to head into their 2020 celebration year.
Finally, Andy Ober, we have a story that's been on Inside Indiana Business involving Governor Eric Holcomb and former LaPorte Mayor Blair Milo. They've gotten together and had more news concerning what is called the Next Level Jobs Programs. Let's hear about that.
And one thing we can tell you, Blair Milo seems to be destined for a lot of political greatness. She has risen up the ranks very quickly and has taken on this workforce development position with the state. And the Next Level Jobs Program, which she is really helping to spearhead with the governor, focuses on getting especially young professionals at one point ready for the workforce. So this provides help with paying for training programs, education programs, to get young workers, in one instance, ready for the workforce. But in another instance, it also helps with grants for adult learners who want to skill up, as they call it, who want new certifications, who need certifications. So this battles not only a skills gap, which is seen very much in Indiana's tech or manufacturing sectors, but it also helps fight automation, which is a problem in every sector, but especially manufacturing, which is so heavy in Indiana. It is helping workers continue to skill up and adapt their skill sets so that they are ready as companies and processes and jobs become more automated to take on the new innovation-driven position. So this is really a forward-looking program from the governor's office to try to get young professionals set to enter the workforce and to get adult professionals to adapt their skill set so they can continue to thrive in the workforce.
In fact, Governor Holcomb is going to be coming up here to Northwest Indiana this afternoon to meet with other officials to talk about some jobs announcements. In fact, you folks had it on the website and in the report this morning about what this is all about, and it is very much related with what Blair Milo is working on.
Yeah, he has been touring the state with Blair Milo to roll out this program, but we are hearing of some additional announcements that will come in your area this morning, and obviously we will be on that throughout the day and update that as the announcements and information come in.
Thanks very much. Andy Ober is the managing editor with Inside Indiana Business Radio out of Indianapolis, and he's with us to bring us up to date on news on the business scene from time to time. In fact, this time around, it's related to education, as the rest of the program is as well, too. Andy, as always, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, and continuing on with our education theme. Today is the first day of classes in the Gary Community Schools. It's a public school district which, as we have heard, is now under state control, and Michael Puente tells us more about it.
Community School Corporation has a structural deficit of $110 million, while the academic performance of its schools is just as troubling. Last spring, Indiana lawmakers approved the first full takeover of any school district. All the important decisions now rest with veteran educator and Gary native Peggy Hinckley. She's already spent $500,000 getting schools, some in poor condition, ready.
I've never been in a school where bathrooms didn't work and plumbing was a problem and leaks, and that's just unacceptable. And I think anything less would have not been proper for the children of Gary.
Hinckley expects the district to have an enrollment of about 5,700 students. I'm Michael Puente.
Indiana's proposed federal education plan's been published. Indiana State Education Department's website is where you can find it if you'd like to check it out. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports it's now in the hands of Governor Eric Holcomb.
Indiana is required to submit a new federal education plan this year as part of the Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaced the No Child Left Behind law in 2015. The plan includes the state's academic standards, how students will be tested on those standards, and plans to help failing schools. It also includes major goals. One of those is closing the achievement gap in English and mathematics by 50% by 2023 for special education students, minorities, and other unique populations. Governor Eric Holcomb now has 30 days to review the plan. The plan is due September 18th to the U.S. Education Department. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
Starting this fall, Indiana University Northwest is going to offer an accelerated program for those people who would like to earn a Master of Public Affairs degree. And to find out more about it, let's talk with Dr. Carl Basil. He is the Assistant Dean and Director of the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, SPIA, as it's more commonly known, on the IU Northwest campus. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris.
For people that are not familiar with what SPIA is, give us a brief description of what the school is and some of the disciplines that are offered for degree work.
Well, SPIA stands for School of Public Environmental Affairs, and the types of degree programs that you could get with a SPIA degree would be everything from criminal justice, public affairs, healthcare management, and we also have a minor in environmental policy.
Now, with this particular opportunity to get a head start on a degree, this is a rather interesting way to be able to get started and get your degree in less time than planned. How long does it normally take to get a Master of Public Affairs degree if you went the traditional route?
Well, Chris, typically it would be at least 2 years, if not most of our students, it takes them 3 years in going the traditional route. So we wanted to accelerate that process, especially for working adults. And at the graduate level, probably most of our students right now are already in healthcare management. So they're already working for a healthcare facility, and they really need to have a little bit more flexibility. So that's going to reduce the amount of time from at least 2 up to 3 years to less than 2 years.
Is there any special coursework that students that are going for this particular degree need to take, or is it pretty much the same for all of the school's coursework?
As far as coursework they would have to take before the graduate program?
Yeah, and this way would introduce them into being able to get into this accelerated program.
Yes, they would have to have a undergraduate degree with a GPA of at least a 3.0. They would have to be in a good academic standing as a undergraduate, And besides that, we have students that have their undergraduate degree in everything from business to a lot of the areas in the humanities. So it really crosses the gamut, but they would have to be in good standing coming into our graduate program.
You mentioned a lot of students that get involved in this particular program are currently working in the healthcare field, and I'm sure that's probably one of many areas that adult students in particular can take advantage of this this degree work.
Yes, this gives them quite a bit of flexibility, definitely a lot more flexibility than what they would have with a traditional degree. And the way that we're able to do that, Chris, is we're offering all of our courses instead of running a full semester, which would be 16 weeks, each class is 8 weeks, and they take them sequentially. So we start out with a cohort of students, and that cohort goes from one 8-week class to another. So essentially, they're able to finish this degree in 4 traditional semesters. Students that would start with us in fall of 2017, so this coming up fall, they would be able to secure their degree if they successfully complete all those classes by spring of 2019, so a little bit less than 2 years.
What kind of feedback have you received from prospective students as well as those who have been involved in the master's programs before there with SPIA, and how they seem to feel this is going to be of a big benefit to them, especially if they're looking to pick up the extra degrees to in turn and advance in whatever careers they're going into?
Chris, all the feedback we've received has been very positive. So the students that are anticipating starting in the fall, their reaction is, I'm so glad that you have this program, and if anything, we really wish that you would have had this program a couple of years ago. So they're very happy about that. And our current alumni, if anything, they've been saying, well, you know, I'm just really glad that IUN SPIA is being very consistent with a lot of trends in higher ed, which is trying to be a little bit more accommodating to working students, but at the same time keeping standards very high. And I think that's a good point to make, is that SPIA is an accredited program, and our SPIA campus in Bloomington was actually ranked number one out of 272 public administration, public affairs programs in the country in the last year.
That's very good. Is this particular program that's being established here at IU Northwest in Gary very similar to maybe similar programs with SPIA at the other campuses, in particular, of course, at Bloomington, but other campuses that offer it as well?
Yes. We have what's called a Memorandum of Understanding, or a MOU, with the Bloomington and IUPUI SPIA campuses. So right now, there are 3 SPIA campuses in the IU system, and all of our curriculum would be identical to what they would have at those 2 other campuses. And I meet periodically with both of the other SPIA deans to ensure the fact that everything that we offer on our campus is very consistent with our sister SPIA programs.
Now, if anybody's interested, still an opportunity to sign up for the fall semester, to be involved in this accelerated program, to be able to earn a Master of Public Affairs degree, how can people do so?
Yes. In fact, our graduate program director, her name is Dawn Sampson, and students should get in touch with her. And all the information is on our website.
Dean, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate the information, and good luck for the program this coming semester.
Well, thanks so much, Chris, and I really enjoy listening to your show.
Residents of Valparaiso wanted to give a unique and everlasting gift to their town, so they set out on a years-long venture to make a documentary for it. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more on that.
What if we made a film about making a film about Valparaiso? Next thing, an hour later, we're still talking about it. And I thought it was so ironic about it. It was an hour earlier, he said, no more new ideas.
7 friends love their city so much, they wanted to give something unique back to it. So they decided to make a movie about Valparaiso, which they say is a love story to the town. The film, Making Paradise, shows the dynamic between the creator's director, Jim Jano Januszewski, film business manager, Steve Antonetti, producer, Tim Daly, Valparaiso legend and idea guy, Bill Wellman, Jason Monroe, local business owner and film promoter Carlos Rivero, and executive producer and director of photography Brad Kavanaugh. The documentary is about Valparaiso and much more.
Bill, I got a great story. Have you seen our museum here?
No.
Your museum?
Uh-huh.
Well, we got a great story on the wall. War of 1812, Admiral Porter.
Porter County.
Fought this big battle in South America, War of 1812. Would that have been against the British? I can't remember who it was against, but they named this county after Admiral Porter. And they named Valparaiso Portersville. And then some sailors that were in that battle down there got pretty loose in a couple bars downtown Valparaiso. And they said, well, you know, really, instead of naming the city Portersville, and they were had a lot to drink, you ought to name it where we actually fought the battle, Valparaiso, Chile.
Is that right?
And if you're going to name the county Porter after the admiral, then you should name the city Valparaiso because that's where the battle was.
Film co-creator Steve Antonetti says he has lived in several states in the Midwest, but he chose to stay in Valparaiso because it has given him and his family so much. He has now been living in the city for almost 20 years. He says the film combines several things he cares deeply about.
It's not too often that you get an opportunity to have the intersection of a lot of the things that you love. I love my town, I love art, I love history, and I love the guys that I had a chance to make this with, and having an opportunity to record something like that for history was something that really motivated me to get involved in the project.
This story is based upon truth. The place it occurred, Valparaiso, Indiana, and the people who took part in it.
Film writer-director Jano says Making Paradise sets out to help enable the people of Valparaiso to know and understand themselves through learning about the city's past and present.
Describe the film.
The purpose of the film was to give back to our community, and the ultimate gift is the gift of self-esteem and self-actualization. So we created a film with the premise that if you understand who you are and you go back into time and you start forward and you understand your community through its culture and it's through its history, it can be entertaining but also create that sense of self-esteem and ultimately give you a sense of where you're going as a community. And we like to think that it's something that goes beyond just the gift of entertainment, but entertainment is the means of how we get there.
One of the purposes, I think, of that really stands out for this documentary is so we can discover and celebrate the unique past, create a new momentum, excitement about the heritage and the future of our town, and to build on a vision of what we will be. I think that's what's the most intriguing purpose of this documentary.
All the film's creators have deep ties to Valparaiso. Daly has lived in Valparaiso his entire life, minus 4 years of college at the now-closed St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer. The creators of Making Paradise also have a strong bond to each other, so says Jano.
The one thing that I think is captured in the film is the dynamics of our group. It truly is an all-for-one and one-for-all kind of mindset, and we, like brothers, we fought along the line, all the way, but like brothers, we always were there for each other. And to achieve this type of, to do something as we've done, you cannot do unless there's a fierce sense of loyalty for each other, and that we had, and that's one of the things that I'll remember the rest of my life. One of the gentlemen on our crew, Carlos Rivero from Don Quixote, he had a simple premise. Let's don't forget that 7,500 years from now, after we're all gone, this is our gift of Valpo. Let's not lose sight of that. And that was definitely one of our incentives, but trying to never let your friends down is a very powerful incentive.
That powerful incentive, along with trying to create a film that was going to stay interesting and relevant, Jano says, was achieved by giving the piece a certain look.
Most of the film is high-def black and white, but it contrasts with everything that's old is generally in color, but it's old school color. And so as a contrast to the black and white, it leads to a thought-provoking ending that we can't reveal to you at this time. But
you have to watch the film. Season,
yeah.
Right?
It's one of the things, when we first got started, we had so many meetings to decide what was this about. And we had so many good reasons to make this. But in the end, we decided that there were so many different ways that we could go that the only thing that we knew for certain is that if we created something that was artistic, it could help everybody and survive the test of time. Where if it was something that was commercial or geared towards something that was current, it wouldn't be evergreen and it wouldn't last. And, you know, they say that an idea that's not good 7 years from now is not a good idea today. We wanted to have something that was good 7 years from now.
So now Valpo's going to have to go the length of the court, 2.5. The inbounds pass to be thrown by Jamie Sykes. Carter pressuring. It's to Jenkins, to Drew for the win! Gone!
Part of the footage from it and part of the interviews that are in it are very well-known people from Valparaiso that, you know, in our community, people like Bruce Leitz, people like Rick Fratasha.
Rick was amazing.
Mark Heckler, Stu McMillan, Jim McGill that owned McGill's.
Of course, if you want to find out who these people are, you have to see the film, which was nominated for Best Documentary Film at the 2017 Prince of Prestige Awards. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much once again to Carmen McCollum of the Times of Northwest Indiana, to Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune, and to Andy Ober with Inside Indiana Business Radio for being on the program today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you on Monday.